This is Story of a Nobody, Chapter 3, Part 1, by Paul Pera. Preface: Keep on Truckin'. One day, while standing at an intersection with the street light flashing wait, I had a psychic awakening. By the time it flashed walk, it occurred to me the world was not so odious, profane, or threatening. It's from Chapter 2. I savored that vision I received exiting the crosswalk. That began the circuitous journey of the early 60s. Many have repeated the well-worn cliché, if you remember the 60s, you weren't there. This is a reference to the copious amount of drug experimentation people my age and younger were indulging in. In fact, much of the 60s could be defined by Max Rafferty, state superintendent of instruction's cynical definition of civil disobedience, cultural and artistic invention as sex, drugs, and treason. Mr. Rafferty most likely didn't dance because he left out the equally compelling component, rock and roll. I did not foresee that desiring a sublime life following Jesus' teachings, emulating his life with deep longing for mystical union, that I would be dancing two blocks from Broadway and Columbus Avenues and Carol Dota's. It was the most iconic corner in North Beach, garishly lit in neon, portal to the Flesh Circus and the Voyeur's Candy Store. In 6 years since the novitiate, I was dancing with a female partner in a burlesque at the Roaring Twenties with a marquee that read, "Hippie Love-In." Different from Carol Dota's, this club was beautifully ornate and well-appointed with faux gas lights, flocked wallpaper, and walnut paneling. It had a darkly quiet interior, contrasted to the gaudy and strident atmosphere of Dota's. My life was looking more like a meandering Jack Kerouac road novel or the inquisitive journey of the Bohemian or Beat Generation. I cherished Thomas Merton's religious conversion in Seven Story Mountain. I just reversed the conversion. Returning to the San Francisco Working Boys Club was comforting after the novitiate. I was moved to the post-high school section with an interesting roommate who was raised in a jungle setting in Brazil. His family was Polish, and he carried many stories of rural tough and pragmatic living in the outback. He wanted to be a priest and possessed religious proclivities of mysticism, magic, and energetic zeal. He was a mentor and a friend. A large question loomed for me: start college as a mid-semester freshman or go to work? I had been living institutionally for 4 years in a boarding school, a boys' home, and a structured monastic novice. Father Flynn was lobbying for me to continue schooling. I ambivalently made the move to St. Mary's College. Whose life was it, I thought? I felt like I was renting my space here. The grand expectations from mentors, confessors, my father, peer pressure, or competition. Any decision was a guess and a gamble, or an effort to please my demons and get them off my back. I had inherited a small stipend that paid for the novitiate and my freshman year at St. Mary's College. At this point, most of the activities of meaning, interest, and substance happened not in a classroom, but on the open road. I became a keen observer, being curious and amused by the family of man. After all, I had transitioned from adolescence that was a baptism of fire, an initiation that either kills you or makes you a survivor. Now I was beginning to embrace the secular world. My intimate love and connection to spiritual life quieted, but it was not abandoned. Poetry became the vehicle and parking place for the nameless muse. St. Mary's was located in pastoral land, still farmed and grazing, with grazing cattle and dairy cows. Fruit trees were plentiful due to the warm summers. Contra Costa had not become completely gentrified in 1963, though much of the infrastructure had been laid in place. Starting mid-semester had many disadvantages. Social contacts had already been formed. Students had become familiar with instructors and their teaching methods, let alone the content of the course. My novitiate group was starting mid-semester too. Passing them between classes became awkward, though I did not regret wearing secular clothes or having the freer structure I was beginning to develop. My length of stay sequestered from the world left me a bit delayed socially. I got a job in the Quadrangle snack shop and began mixing with the student body. My graduating senior high school group had started a year and a half prior. Some of my high school friends were spending an inordinate amount of time playing chess, trying to hypnotize students, and raiding the kitchen at night after becoming friends with the graveyard security guard. I entered psychotherapy with Dr. Fred D. Whelan, Ph.D. I had begun seeing him at the novitiate briefly and continued at St. Mary's. He was the head of the psychology department, and against his advice, I took his psychology 1B and received an F in that class. In hindsight, getting a failing grade from your psychologist was like thumbing my nose at the process. I believe the most important lessons I learned, however, occurred away from the classroom. Schooling provided for teaching and book education, while visceral learning happened away from the hallowed grounds of academia. That is, with the exception of writing poetry, which began with the encouragement of Professor John Logan, a man who knew how to bring the most from his students. Another example of acting defiantly is St. Mary's had a no facial hair policy. I grew a beard. Brother Cashin, FSC, was prefect at the dining hall, and he would not allow me to eat with the student body until I shaved. I ate in the professor's dining hall by myself as penance for early individuation. I was beginning not to be intimidated by and questioned ideas that previously I blindly obeyed. In a few months, the policy changed, and Brother Cashin himself sported a beard. Next, I bought a new motorcycle against the advice of the probate attorney of my grandmother's estate and my father's wishes. I bought a machine I did not know how to drive. It took someone else to drive it from San Francisco, the dealership, while I rode on the back. After classes, I rode on campus and back roads surrounding St. Mary's. There was a fire igniting in me that was new, strange, and a departure from pre-novitiate behavior. Whatever the tangent my personality was taking, I rode hard on its tail. After 1 year at St. Mary's, I was ready to move back to San Francisco. I enrolled in San Francisco State because John Logan, my writing mentor, also began teaching there. He allowed me to take a postgraduate seminar. I enrolled in two classes besides the poetry class. By this time, I had published in 5 college poetry journals. It was at this time I was notified by the house manager at the Working Boys Club that I would need to find different living arrangements. If Father Flynn was questioning my moral commitment to Catholic practice, he was correct. I was no longer obsessed with parsing mortal and venial sins or the near occasion of impure thought or touch. I longed to have a girlfriend and get over the initiation of losing virginity. Though in the 60s, with the pill and contraception, disappointment and a sense of betrayal by church and government, a foment and disgust and anger roiled in the loins of men and women of my generation. It was as if time had arrived to celebrate a new permissiveness and question all things bureaucratic, governmental, and systems as a whole. I met my first girlfriend at San Francisco State in graduate seminar. Her name was Vita Lorello. She was wild and impulsive and physically passionate. She bumped a previous boyfriend to date me. I didn't see that this was an indication of the future. Vita means life in Latin, and since I had no experience in romance, she became my teacher and life coach in matters of romance. This was a whole new adventurous, novel, and edgy experience. We hitchhiked from San Francisco to Denver. It took about 23 rides. We hopped a freight in Elko, Nevada with the engineer's permission. We stayed in the brakeman's cabin, who made his drunken rounds, tried to seduce Vita, noticed me, thought I was an Indian, and kicked us down to the next Flatiron boxcar. We woke up at sunrise on the Great Salt Lake with deer walking over the colored coral flats. From Salt Lake City and breakfast, the cowboy handyman picked us up and dropped us in the outback. We drank whiskey along the way and listened to really bad off-collar jokes. He said I could help him repair a roof and he'd buy us dinner, or we could take our chances thumbing it. Standing in the 100-degree heat with only a hearse passing by, I had no choice but to carry shingles up a ladder while he patched the roof. He drove us to the next highway and bought us a steak dinner. At twilight, we suffered a scourge of mosquitoes, hungry for California tourists. We were saved by a migrant field worker white family as they were going directly to Denver. The car, which her father promised, was only the ruse to get Vita to visit him in Denver. There was also an expiration date on the closeness and trust I had for her. She had numerous affairs, and due to my naivete, I did not see them developing. When I did, I got hurt and felt foolish. It was the early 60s. Free love for a Catholic boy was intimidating and alluring. I did not believe I had the uninhibited personality to thrive and wondered how others managed it. I think I was developmentally still a teenager. I had not worn off the patina of my early innocence. At this time, poems were flowing through me. I had a natural ease with lyrical imagery. I loved Lorca, the South American poets, and Rimbaud. I hit a wall and made a decision based on a crisis of anxiety. I was becoming more isolated. I anticipated a lonely, dark future as a writer of poetry. I did not have supports or balances in place to cope with the muse. I needed to use my body, dance, hard work, or exercise. I may have needed time to integrate more life experience, so this deep current of feeling or spontaneous inspiration was not so threatening. In a few years' time, dance integrated the volatile currents that earlier I could not shelter. Exposure to mental illness in my family led me to quietly avoid things that could lead to talented madness. A number of my friends had psychological breaks in their early 20s. an artist friend, painted a large canvas he titled Rainy Day Session of seven friends who didn't transition into their late 20s. I wished to survive, and poetry seemed too close to the edge I could not tolerate at that time.